but particularly with human eye contact. Humans are unique among animals in that the contrast between the white, the pupil, and the iris of our eyes is greater than any other species. We get an enormous amount of social information through human eye contact, something that I will point out can only happen on foot, in person, and at 5 kilometers per hour or less. The other way, however, that we release oxytocin in our bodies is through exercise, particularly walking and bicycling. So, if driving, the science tells us, makes us fat, sick, die early, poor, dumb, angry, and mistrustful, and if walking and biking makes us fitter and smarter, able to handle complex reasoning better, the science tells us, sexier, more loving, and more trustful, then why are we still designing our cities around this rather than this or this? If these were the design vehicle for our transportation system, imagine how much more healthy our cities would be and how much happier all of us would be. So what can you do? Well, the first place to start is to measure success properly, to make sure that everything that you care about in your community is defined clearly in a statement of goals that then follow through to related measurable targets and that have implementable strategies associated with them, and then most importantly, have quantifiable performance measures by which your city officials can judge whether or not they have achieved those goals. If something's just nice and can't be measured, it's going to be ignored. Step two. Fix your street standards and your street and transportation performance measures. This street, in fact, basically all of your favorite streets in any city that you've ever been to, is likely illegal in that community. It violates every rule of proper street design, and particularly it violates the rules of safe street design. Look at the factors that you love about your favorite streets and make sure that not only are those factors legal, but that your city traffic engineers are required to design streets that you will love walking along. Number three, rethink traffic mitigation. So one of the things that my industry does, spends a lot of time doing, it's our biggest moneymaker, is analyzing the traffic impact of new development. And we typically analyze the impacts of new development according to a single factor, intersection level of service for motor vehicles. By which we measure the seconds of delay that cars experience at an intersection, not the seconds of delay that people experience at an intersection. So a bus with 40 people on it, those people are valued at 1/40th as relevant as a car with one person in it. Interesting way to look at things. So if you're looking at seconds of delay, the solutions for fixing traffic congestion are to widen roadways, to reduce density, to add parking, or best of all, to move the project to a more isolated rural location where there's not current traffic congestion. Of course, the implication of any of these is to worsen the very problem that we're trying to solve. This is at the root of the unsustainability of all of the practices in my industry, and it needs to change. Step four, legalize walkable neighborhoods. The city of Vancouver is the best model to follow in all of North America. If your zoning makes it impossible for someone to reasonably walk to get a quart of milk, your zoning is unsustainable. Step five, get smart about parking. This is an all-day lecture in and of itself, and perhaps the most powerful tool that cities have at their disposal in order to fix some of their sustainability problems and their economic problems in a very, very fast way. So some of the things that we talk to a lot of cities about, eliminating minimum parking requirements. We don't have minimum housing requirements for people. Why do we need minimum housing requirements for cars? Creating park once environments in our business districts where somebody can park their car once and do six different things. Charging the right price for curb parking to make sure that there are a few parking spaces available on every block, in every parking lot, in every parking garage to actually not use the Soviet communist method of allocating scarce resources as we currently do for parking, but not for housing or food. And instead, let the market work for us. And finally, manage your parking in order to achieve your city's larger development, congestion management, other goals. And finally, step six, make walking a joyous and delightful part of everyday life. And Brent talked about beauty, Hank talked about joy, and I would talk about delight, because the most important factors of sustainability are these factors that generate love. We know from sustainability science that the most sustainable thing that we can do is to maintain what we already have. And things don't get maintained if they're not lovable. Make your buildings lovable, make your communities lovable, and create cities in which we can all love each other. In order to do that, you all need to be at the table when decisions are made about the built environment, and be advocating for that humans matter, and that our health, our spiritual, our physical, our mental health all matter in decisions about the built environment, recognizing that the built environment is managed by dozens of different bureaucratic agencies, people in silos who are not talking to each other, people who have over-professionalized their work and have complex formulas designed so that you cannot understand them. You need to understand those formulas. The ones in my profession are really quite easy. What we do is not rocket science. We've got a lot of big words that try to obfuscate and make it seem like it's harder than it is. It's really not. You can all fix the problems in transportation that create these unsustainable factors. So the other critically important thing to keep in mind is that time is running out, and we need to move beyond platitudes and move beyond general statements about yay sustainability, and instead get into the DNA of how our communities are built and funded and how the success of those communities is measured, making sure that human physical, emotional, and spiritual health are factored into those formulas. Rome burned while Nero fiddled. And we have the opportunity to lose an awful lot if we fiddle around with public health in our communities, and yet so very, very much to gain if we understand these factors and get them right. Thank you.
That speech titled Alive Transportation, Fitness, Safety, Community, and Trust was by Jeff Tumlin, a principal at Nelson Nygaard Transportation Planning in beautiful San Francisco. It was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock on October 7th, 2010 at the Gaining Ground Ecological Conference in Vancouver, Canada.
Now, from one news speaker to another, this is a 2010 interview by KMO of Sea Realm Podcast, episode 212, with Jeff Vail, who wrote A Theory of Power. And I think he successfully nuances Kunstler's description of energy descent by looking at changing political realities. He's focusing on the hierarchical structure of the nation state and asking, has it outlived its useful life? And is it going to manage to perpetuate itself in an era of energy descent and with increasing public awareness that as long as it's using money, it's going to be under the control of larger commercial forces who may not have the interests of citizens at heart, he said, putting it mildly.
I have got basically one page of just little phrases that I've written down from your writing. And I think the obvious place to start is with the big picture. And a phrase that you're using quite a bit is the diagonal economy. And if you would say a bit about the diagonal economy.
So for me, the diagonal economy is an attempt to capture, and I suppose it's really a fairly complex notion, that I think that localization, scale-free self-sufficiency is the only effective way to deal with the need to build systems for our future that will provide high quality of life, but that will accept ongoing declines in the amount of energy we can be using, as well as other issues, whether it's climate change, declines in the amount of water available, all these kinds of things, I think can best be addressed by localized self-sufficiency, or rather scale-free self-sufficiency, localization, and a variety of other concepts. But at the same time, I think it would be completely unrealistic to say, well, let's just abandon the state and go build our own, global, worldwide network of localized, self-sufficient eco-villages. I think that that can happen in some very isolated locations, but I think that as a people, we can't expect that to be the vehicle for transition for the masses, mainly because the state, corporations, the powers that be, if you will, are simply not going to say, okay, you know what, we'll walk away and you guys go do your thing. They want to continue to regulate. They want to continue to be in charge or at least maintain the facade of control. So to me, the diagonal economy is this compromise whereby we can build these local networks that coexist with the centralized hierarchical state structure industrial economy, and then gradually they become more important as I think the state, as is frankly probably inevitable, fades away. I've written a fair amount on the challenges facing the nation-state system going forward, and I don't see how the nation-state system can remain viable in its current form, and lots of theorists, Philip Bobbitt, for example, have suggested, well, it's going to transition to a market state where the state abandons the nation and hangs onto the market as its claim to legitimacy. I think it's already happened to a large degree, but I think that's going to really disenfranchise and essentially abandon the median person. You know, it might keep average wealth high, but most people, there'll be a few very rich, and most people will, I think, do much worse under that kind of system. And to me, a diagonal economy, kind of a simultaneous growing of a localized, scale-free, self-sufficient network of economics, of personal connections, I think that is the best way to deal with that change in our state structure, our government structure. And I think that it's something that we can look on as a more realistic path forward than, you know, we have to bring down the governments and build a localized green alternative, or equally unrealistic, we have to convince the governments to be appropriate and green and to actually support the needs and the desires of their constituents.
Well, Jeff, I'm pretending right now that I'm reading a transcript of your last answer. And hopefully I'm reading it on the web, and it's hyperlinked, and I want to click on the hyperlink for scale-free self-sufficiency.
Right.
What do we find on that page?
So I think scale-free self-sufficiency is a really important concept, and it's this idea that self-sufficiency is very important, I think, because it helps us not need to enter into hierarchical relationships, enter into power relationships with states, with governments, with strongmen, feudal powers, whatever it may be, in order to have our needs met. If we can meet our own needs, then we don't have to enter into these hierarchical relationships. And the problem, the key problem as I see it with hierarchy is twofold. It doesn't work for people. I mean, it's just not pleasant to be at the base of the pyramid. But probably more importantly, more systemic, I think it's the driver of growth, the driver of the perpetual growth that makes our civilization fundamentally unsustainable. When you have multiple hierarchies competing in peer polity competition, you have to either be growing and expanding so you can outcompete your neighbor, or else whichever neighbor has that adaptation is going to grow and expand and outcompete you, and you're going to be subsumed into it. So I think that's the importance of self-sufficiency, but I think all of us will accept total self-sufficiency is neither realistic, nor, frankly, is it really desirable. I think you don't want to sit on a small farm by yourself or with your immediate family and never have any contact and be doing absolutely everything yourself, including, you know, medicine and arts and education and growing all of your food. It's placing the locus of self-sufficiency too far down on the spectrum, and I think it doesn't lend well to resiliency, because one small failure there and there's no network of connections to help you out. So the concept of scale-free self-sufficiency is sort of a compromise where it's the idea that you push to the lowest reasonable and realistic level as much self-sufficiency as possible. You know, in practical terms, that might mean if you can grow 25% of your calories and nutrition on your property or in your community garden, and then you can rely on your immediate community or reasonably immediate community for the next 25%, in your bioregion for the next 25%, and only 25% are actually imported from a distance, that would be a scale-free self-sufficiency. There's this drive towards self-sufficiency that looks similar no matter what level on the scale you're observing the system. And that's really the nature of fractals. You keep zooming in and it looks the same. And same thing with water self-sufficiency, with government self-sufficiency, education, healthcare, defense, you name it.
Well, you've also brought up a couple of mathematical terms, and math was never my strong suit.
Well, me either.
I've got a pretty good handle on what an average is, but if you would refresh me and the audience on the difference between a mean and a median.
I think this is a really key concept, and I think it's one of those things that is very effectively used to deceive with statistics. It's not lying because they're being accurate, but it's really deceptive. If you look at the mean, is take the, let's say, mean income among 10 people. Add up all 10 people's income, divide by 10. That's your mean. Now, median would be the middle person's income. So it would be that income between the fifth and the sixth person out of 10. If you rank order them from lowest earning to highest earning, the fifth to the sixth person, that difference between there would be the median income. Now, this is really important because imagine the difference between two groups. One group of 10 people where everyone earns $45,000 a year. Or for making the math easier, let's say everyone earns $50,000 a year. The mean income and the median income is $50,000. Now, let's imagine a group of 10 people where one person earns $500,000 a year and 9 people earn $1 a year. The mean income, meaning the average or mean, same term, the mean income in that group is still $50,000 a year, $50,001 roughly. But the median income is $1 a year. So there's a huge discrepancy between those. And you see that, go to let's say, African countries or Middle Eastern countries, and you'll see a much bigger difference between the mean income and the median income, which means there's more disparity in society. In America, we're moving in that direction to a greater difference between the mean and the median, but we're still closer. And I think that it's hard to hold civil society together when you have this huge disparity. I mean, when you get closer toward the very, very high income of a very few and then very, very low income of the masses that you'd see in whether it's feudalism or any kind of totalitarian dictatorship or even just very unequal societies, I think that is the kind of society we just don't want. It's less enjoyable to live in than a society, probably not where everyone earns the same amount, but where there's a much closer clustering or a much more even distribution.
You know, if you are looking to create a situation where the median income is a livable, respectable, comfortable place to be, and if you're looking to provide more people with that level of dignity and comfort and sustainability and security, then what you're talking about is something that gets derided in the media as redistribution of wealth or redistribution of income, which has been pretty thoroughly branded as evil socialism verging on communism. Are you hoping to sort of avoid that linguistic trap by using novel terminology?
I'm not too concerned about that brand. I think that there's a lot of value in it. In going toward, I think redistribution is actually a very good systemic trait. We tend to have a system that funnels income toward one end of the spectrum, and I think that a system which would be a positive feedback loop that tends to be systems that go out of control and then break, whereas from a systemic perspective, a negative feedback loop, a dampening function that redistributes the income at least to some degree, is a sign of systems that are much more stable, much more resilient, and much longer lasting. But I think, my focus really is on not so. I think there's a divide between income and what I think are more important measures like quality of life or happiness. Very difficult to measure, certainly. But I'd much rather focus on increasing the median quality of life or ensuring long-term, sufficient median quality of life, median happiness. And I think we can do a lot of that without resorting to income, frankly. If you're going back to the scale-free self-sufficiency concept, if you're looking at food self-sufficiency, for example, and I divide that into three categories. I'd say, nutrition, calories, and kind of quality of food, whether it's taste or cultural appropriateness or whatever the case may be.
Gastronomy.
You can, exactly, that's probably the perfect term for it. If you can increase the median access to that, through scale-free self-sufficiency, meaning that individuals and then local communities grow more of that themselves, I think you can dramatically increase median quality of life, median happiness, without having any change in income or any redistribution of income. I think that at best we can at least ask, or at least we can ask the government, the state, whatever structure it may be, to not introduce policies that inhibit that kind of a process.
Well, it's a little late to ask them not to introduce such policies. At this point,
undo
we
might
to
be a better. Undo is probably a far better term there. But, you know, I suppose people oftentimes say, well, it can't get any worse, and I think this is a case where it certainly could.
Yeah.
So we need to stop the direction it's currently moving and then worry about reversing the direction.
Well, an ongoing theme on the CROM podcast is just sort of crusade to get people to recognize that there is a difference between standard of living and quality of life, and that you can have a pretty high standard of living and yet still have a pretty low quality of life. And in fact, that is the basis for consumer capitalism. It's just keeping everybody in a dissatisfied state, but having them believe that, you know, satisfaction is just the next purchase away. And a sort of complementary theme to that is this idea that if you understand what makes humans tick, if you understand evolutionary psychology, and if you understand human needs for socialization and for respect from one's peers, then actually providing quality of life is not that expensive. And a phrase that I've written down from your recent writing is, quote, a metric based on fulfillment of humanity's genetic ontogeny. There's a lot going on in that fragment of a sentence. I wonder if you would unpack that, and I'll read it once more. A metric based on fulfillment of humanity's genetic ontogeny.
Right. So I don't have the perfect prototype metric to propose to you, but I can certainly explain what I'm looking for. You know, to me, genetic ontogeny is simply we have as humans gone through a course of evolution that sets certain genetically driven requirements. You know, I think that there's lots of more sophisticated, whether it's through spirituality or psychology or the occult or you name it, ways of trying to mediate between different parts of our brain. But at a very simple level, and I think for the vast majority of people, we need certain things. You know, take, for example, Dunbar's number. We are genetically well adapted to deal in groups of connections between people of about 150 different people. If we have to deal on a regular basis with far more people than that, then we don't deal well. And if we have far fewer people than that, then we have psychological issues stemming from isolation. So, you know, that's one small example. I think the same thing is, you know, very, very simple thoughts like sun, decently nutritious food, and exercise. You know, we need that. You know, having enough free time. You know, I think if you look at the work schedules of most, you know, if we can, to the extent that we can accurately through ethnographic studies or observing contemporaneous tribes look at, for example, the Kung or various other groups, how many hours a week do they work and what's their work schedule like? It's not 9 to 5, certainly, 5 days a week. And I think that the dream of 9 to 5, 5 days a week is quickly vanishing from the American vocabulary anyway. You know, I think that we are much more genetically adapted to kind of working when we feel like it, sleeping when we feel like it, socializing when we feel like it, and being in small group environments where other people are all doing the same. And to the extent,
I'm certainly well adapted to that lifestyle.
I'm well adapted to it. I just find it incompatible with other parts of my lifestyle, unfortunately. You know, I think I'm doing my best to change my lifestyle more in that direction right now. But I think that, you know, Americans can recognize, and people all over the world probably can recognize, it's a challenge. It is fundamentally opposed to what the industrial economy needs and expects, what the nation state transitioning to the market state needs and expects out of people living within its borders. And I think that's problematic. So I'd love to see at least some moves toward building a metric so that we could measure how well societies, different styles of living, et cetera, meet the requirements of our genetic ontogeny, because I think that's, you know, happiness is so subjective, but I think we can at least create a more objective baseline if we look at, well, this style of living, however you may define it, A versus B, A better meets our genetic ontogeny than does B.
So what a lot of this revolves around, and we haven't touched on it yet, is this notion of suburban living versus urban living versus rural living. folks like Jim Kunstler are fond of saying that, you know, what we need to revive are the medium-sized cities that have sort of been abandoned in favor of either megalopolises or just everybody moving to the suburbs. And what I seem to be getting from what you're saying is that, no, really, we don't need that huge density of population to have the sort of opportunities for satisfying interaction that we crave. And when it comes time to really dig down on some topic and specialize and really look for a good conversation, it doesn't matter how big your city is. You're probably not going to find the level of conversation that you might get if you converse with people online at the oil drum or similar places, or, you know, energy bulletin.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that there is a lot of value to face-to-face interaction, but I don't think, especially with our communication capabilities now, I mean, witness that we are states apart speaking over the phone, you know, based on having found each other through, I assume, various chat rooms and internet message boards and that kind of thing. I think that people can connect with like-minded people or people that they need information from or have information to share with almost without regard to geography these days. I think that there's a lot less basis for this view that we need to go away from suburbs and towards cities. My concerns with suburbs are there are a lot of fundamentally unsustainable things about the way we currently live in them. But I'm actually very optimistic about one feature of suburbia, which is it is probably the most democratic distribution of land ownership at a level where you could at least begin to move towards scale-free self-sufficiency that we've ever seen. So I think we have to try to adapt the suburbs and the cities, because frankly, cities will have a very difficult time in, you know, much more dense urban environments, very challenging time moving toward any kind of reasonable scale-free self-sufficiency. They're really stuck in a hierarchical mode of operation. And that, again, from this growth perspective, is really problematic. If you're going to, it doesn't matter how sustainable your city is, if it's driven toward permanent, perpetual growth, it's not sustainable.
A point that you've made pretty clearly and consistently in your writing is that cities, when we view them as through the lens of what you call peer polity competition, are in competition with one another for control of agricultural hinterlands and things of that nature, and that much like corporations, the demands of the short term, particularly in competition with others like themselves, drive cities to adopt policies and strategies which are not sustainable and not viable on the long term. And yet you're talking about transitioning away from these sort of hierarchical, structured ways of competing that favor growth. And I'm just a little confused as to how one can move away from a growth-centered strategy when other people are still employing that strategy, and when failing to employ it while your competitors are still doing so is likely to give the game to your competitors.
Well, I think that the key is to both move towards scale-free self-sufficiency while at the same time organizing and raising a collective consciousness of the importance of not engaging in that competition, but of mediating against that competition kind of absorbing the areas that are moving towards scale-free self-sufficiency. And that's something that I think, you know, I probably have not thought through as well as it needs to be thought through, because it gets into these very sticky areas of interaction with the state, the degree of resistance versus compliance, issues like physical defense, issues like ownership within the state legal structure. I mean, I think that it's a challenging area, but I do think that regardless of whether or not you're in a big city or in suburbia, I think, or in the rural hinterlands or exurbia or you name it, you can move towards scale-free self-sufficiency simply by reducing your dependence on things that come from very far away or from very hierarchical, specialized, centralized production processes, and moving more toward artisanal, personal production, that kind of mode of production. I think that it begins to reduce the power that these hierarchies have. It kind of takes the wind out of their sails to some extent if this was done on a large scale. And it certainly, I think, at least puts you in a position to better network with other people. You know, I don't think this is a case where you want to atomize your economic relationships to where you're just one small isolated group or isolated individual or local connection. I think it's very important to push the level of self-sufficiency down as aggressively as you can while equally aggressively building networks on all levels. Because I think that it's those networks that will then have the collective power to actually compete, well, to resist this kind of peer polity pressure coming from hierarchy seeking to grow and shield their constituents from, the oppressive forces or from, maybe in a bit more generic term, just shield their constituents from the regulations, laws, and market power of these large hierarchies to allow them to keep that level of self-sufficiency as low as possible. And I think that that's a structure that doesn't organically require growth to any degree, but I think it can grow by adding new members and by expanding its reach without expanding its control in any way, expanding its consumption in any way. So I think that it's compatible with this no-growth model or this no-growth imperative, and could also effectively compete or at least shield against those entities that need to keep growing.
You know, you've written and mentioned in this interview even the nation state.
Mm-hmm.
And you cited somebody who said that we're moving from a nation state to a market state. And if you would say a little bit more about what that means and what it would look like to live in a market state.
Well, Philip Bobbitt is he's a law professor at the University of Texas, I believe, but he's written probably the most interesting book on this topic, which is called The Shield of Achilles. I've written a paper that kind of takes my view on it because I disagree strongly with his ultimate conclusions. My paper is called The New Map. But the bottom line is, right now, at least in theory, we live in a nation-state system. And I'll skip the whole evolution of the nation-state and how we got to where we are today. But bottom line is, the state is the government apparatus, and the nation is this theoretically, culturally, or oftentimes theoretically, ethnically homogeneous constituency. And then the idea is the boundaries of the state are the same as the boundaries of the nation. And so this is kind of your social contract concept. The nation gives sovereignty to the state. The state, in return, takes care of the needs of the nation. This was the model that at least in political theory, or at least in mainstream political theory, was dominant in the West, certainly for the second half of the 20th century, and is still presumed to be the case almost universally today. So that's the nation-state concept. The problem is there was never a perfect overlap between the boundaries of the state and the nation. There was never a ethnically homogenous or culturally homogenous nation to begin with. And the state recently has increasingly been unable to provide for the needs of its theoretical constituent nation, in part because that nation may be outside of its geographic borders, or other nations may be inside of its theoretical geographic borders, or there are affinity groups that go in all kinds of diagonals, whether they're ideological, religious, immigrants, you name it. So I think that this tendency is really only increasing, where the mismatch between the nation and the state is growing. And so this whole system is really breaking down. And I think you see this everywhere from places like Nigeria, where there's this theoretical nation state set up by the British, or Iraq, exact same issue. But the nations that are supposed to be the constituents of that state really don't match up, don't get along, and the state can't provide for the needs of the nation, so they look to alternative affinities, whether that's local tribes, local governments, religions, etc. And you also see that in the U.S. with our inability to, say, provide universal health care, or Europeans, where they do provide all kinds of services but now can't afford to pay for them, which was relatively predictable. So Philip Bobbitt, his theory is that we're moving toward a market state. The state, as its basis for legitimacy, is moving away from this concept that we're legitimate because we took care of our nation, to we're legitimate because we maintain a viable and vibrant market. But that market, of course, is a market from the state's perspective, so it's hierarchical, top-down, highly centralized, and it's geared toward maximizing the mean, not maximizing the median. It really is moving away from any attempt to take care of this theoretical nation, which arguably never existed, and I think that's what opens up this huge opportunity for what I call the diagonal economy, or for just pushing toward highly networked groups of scale-free, self-sufficient communities to begin taking care of themselves within the kind of crumbling or increasingly irrelevant auspices of a market state that's providing sort of overarching structure. So I hope that answered your question a bit. I think the reason it would be unpleasant to live in a market state is it has almost admittedly abandoned whatever it once theoretically called its nation, and it's focusing on maximizing the mean standard of living as opposed to the median quality of life.
So I'll be repeating things that you've said here, I think, just for help in getting these ideas across to people who haven't read much of your work. You can have a system where the mean income or the mean wealth, we'll say, is very, very high, and most of the people living in that system have a very, very tiny percentage of that to themselves, and a very few people have an enormous percentage of it. And you can have another system where the median represents, you know, where most of the wealth is, and you've got some outliers up and down, but nothing like what you have in this other example. And in the more sort of egalitarian, median-centered example, you could have a smaller economy, you could have less total wealth. And for somebody who has who is in, you know, one of the top tiers of wealth, it's very easy and comforting for them to adopt the just the axiom, really, that the larger the total pie, the better, because they've got a huge slice of it. But people who are getting much smaller slices of the pie, they don't care so much about the total size of the pie, so long as their piece is reasonably sized.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a very accurate way of saying it, and I think it comes down to we care about two things. Well, really, we care about one thing. How big is my slice of the pie? But a really important and often neglected component of that slice of the pie is a huge, almost overwhelming proportion of our wealth is the kind of community we live in, the kind of society we live in. And I think that a society that, you know, where our slice of the pie includes a relatively egalitarian society that is peaceful and sustainable and cooperative, I think that is a huge potential way to increase our wealth without maybe increasing our monetary wealth. And I think that that's something that it's very difficult to maintain that kind of the intrinsic wealth of our civil society when we have this huge disparity between the power and wealth of some people and the power and wealth of the masses.
Well, you know, the King of Bhutan, I think, proposed using the metric of gross national happiness to judge, you know, how well government policies are being implemented in Bhutan. And I spoke several years ago now with a gentleman who runs an organization called, I believe it's the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. And he had some metrics that he had come up with, which diverge from gross national product and, you know, the standard metrics for how we're doing economically. And he had substituted some metrics that would be decent indicators of the health of the economy in a steady state economy. And I have to say, his metrics didn't stick with me. I can't even name them right now. And it seems that so much of the challenge that people thinking about a way to move to a new, more sustainable, more humane system face is just communicating the advantages of that system to other people. And I like what you do, but your work is filled with these seemingly esoteric phrases that are hooks for much larger ideas. And if you don't know the meaning of those phrases, then, you know, one of your essays could be a pretty daunting read. And I just wonder, this is a question that I ask of a lot of people, it comes up a lot, how much of the population has to have any sort of intellectual understanding of the things that we're talking about in order to move, you know, in a progressive direction, in order to move toward flatter hierarchies and more egalitarian societies and just a better quality of life for everybody?
Yeah, I think that's a real key problem that we face. You know, I certainly admit I don't do a very good job of creating, I guess, you know, mass market material. I'm fortunate, I suppose, that I don't, maybe I'm unfortunate that I'm not able to. I don't earn my living from my writing and my theorizing. I would love to if I could find a way to to make that pay, but I really do it for my own benefit and for the benefit of, you know, the few people that I talk to on a regular basis and interact with. And my intent is to kind of explore the theoretical side of it, but I think that the way – I don't think it's realistic to expect – everyone, enough people, 50-plus percent, I'm not sure where the threshold is of society, to want to or to take the time to have this kind of a more theoretical understanding of why they're doing what they're doing. What I do think, though, works is kind of a three-tiered process where you have, and these are certainly not exclusive groups by any means, there can be great overlap between them, but a group of people that are creating the theoretical concepts, then a second group of people are implementing, another kind of early adapter group are implementing, and then showing people in what I would call the masses third group that, hey, these people in the second group are doing this, and this is a lot more enjoyable, sustainable, than what the masses in group three are doing as far as working in the industrial state economy. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying my plan is to try and make sure I have a theoretical basis for implementing this in my life or helping other people actually implement it in their lives so that the masses then, I think, can see that and can say, now that I actually see it in action, it makes sense, and whether or not I have the time or the inclination to have a complete theoretical understanding of why that's the case, not important. I see it in action, it's better, it's what I would rather be doing, rather be part of than what I'm currently doing, and I'm going to move in that direction. And then I think once you get people wanting to move in that direction, helping them with concrete steps toward, for example, increasing scale-free self-sufficiency is really a pretty easy process.
Well, you've got your spinners of theoretical concepts, the early implementers, and then the evangelists to the masses. I talk to a lot of people who think they've got a pretty good plan worked out, and if they can just convince everybody else to adopt it, we're going to be fine. But I suspect that whatever arrangement, you know, we come to is not going to be one that anybody thoroughly visualized in advance and then sold to the masses and that we all voted and agreed upon and decided to implement. I think much more likely what we're going to end up with is something that is somewhat workable, somewhat livable, but totally emergent and organic and unplanned.
And I certainly agree with that. I think that's why, rather than saying, you know, here's how to build your house, here's how much garden you have to have, here's the kind of way you should earn, you know, money for exchange, et cetera, I think that we need – that's why I think that there really is a great importance. It's not just this abstract theory on concepts like increasing scale-free self-sufficiency. I think that's something that is going to be perhaps not a universal truth, but it's going to be kind of a force that will work to varying degrees in millions of different ways of approaching this kind of a problem. You know, I also think that people that are early adopters, people that are pioneers in these areas, are kind of setting up concepts that can be expanded upon when the broader situation changes to the point that it's more relevant or people are more interested. Right now, I mean, if things continued exactly the way they are right now in our civilization for the next 100 years, I'm not sure that I would anticipate a huge amount of change. I think that energy descent, the ongoing inability of the nation state to care for its nation, I think those kind of big picture trends are really going to increase the focus and increase the interest of the population at large of adopting some of these right now, which would be very alternative or extreme concepts.
Do you think perhaps the Gulf oil spill might turn out to be a boon in that respect?
I'm reserving judgment. My gut feeling is no. My gut feeling is it's going to be a great political talking point for a while that's going to have effectively zero impact. But I am looking forward to being proven wrong.
Well, there's another phrase that I read in your writing repeatedly this morning, and that is vernacular technologies. What do you mean by vernacular technologies?
So I mean two things by vernacular technologies, although initially I only meant one, I should say, and I'm kind of expanding the concept. Initially what I meant by vernacular technologies are village craft, artisanal craft, things that don't require highly specialized and therefore hierarchical and centralized workforces and experts to accomplish. So computers generally, although I think there's some important and growing exceptions to this, but you know, information technology might be not a vernacular concept, whereas architecture certainly can be, but it also can be a non-vernacular concept. I think it's a really important thing that we base, as we push towards scale-free self-sufficiency, we include information in that. Self-sufficient in the type of expertise, knowledge, and information that we need. And whether that's healthcare or architecture or engineering or farming or nutrition or you name it, I think that we want to use concepts at as local a level as possible that don't require hierarchical structures to understand and implement. You know, I think I've expanded that, at least in my own mind recently, to increasingly incorporating open source concepts. I think that the potential for innovation and for maintaining a knowledge bank and for knowledge management of an open source system shared between many, many local but networked groups is really huge. And I think that it can manage and better innovate and better organize information than even some of the largest hierarchies, which I think are extremely inefficient precisely because of the information processing burden of their structure.
I'm lucky in that I will be listening to this at least twice as I edit it. I know that I'll be increasing my level of comprehension to your answers as I go, and I would encourage the listeners, rather than to just sort of shrug and say, I don't get it, to go back and listen again, because these things really do tend to require a few passes and a few just a few iterations before they take shape in one's mind.
And, you know, I think that as in all these cases, if we had, you know, all day to discuss one of these areas, we could really delve into concrete examples that'd be much easier to understand. But just on the vernacular, just on the vernacular technology side, you know, let's talk about gardening versus industrial farming. You know, gardening is a vernacular technology. It's something that can be extremely sophisticated, but it's something that anyone in the village level, even on, you know, the urban garden, suburbia, exurbia, you name it, can become highly proficient at gardening. And there's a huge potential to share through open source communication systems, best practices, tips, locally appropriate techniques, you name it, in concepts like permaculture or hydroponics or whatever the case may be, that's really a vernacular technology. In contrast, consider, I guess, the agribusiness's approach to improving yields, improving resiliency, crop production, that kind of thing, would be genetic engineering, biotechnology. You know, I think the genetic engineering versus plant breeding is maybe like the classic example of the differences between the two. Any village gardener can engage in a breeding program and create a unique, locally appropriate strain of whatever plant they're working on that's going to be more pest resistant, more productive, tastier, etc. You know, a highly centralized lab of highly trained scientists with huge computer systems and gross budgets working on genetic engineering that same strain of plants will never have the motivation to focus on what's going to work in that one gardener's yard. They might make something that, you know, is Roundup ready or that's appropriate for large swaths of land to some degree, but it will never achieve the same level of excellence as that one carefully bred, you know, strain of tomatoes or whatever the case may be. So I think that's a good example of some of the differences between vernacular technology as opposed to the way our present industrial economy approaches technology.
John Michael Greer talks about similar topics, and I think what you're calling vernacular technology, he calls trailing edge technology. But his sort of paradigm example is the difference between a slide rule and an electronic calculator. The slide rule is sort of, well, it's transparent in its operations. There's no proprietary source code. There's no hidden algorithm that is being carried out, you know, inside the machine. You manipulate it. You can see what results you get when you do. And somebody who has your slide rule and who has access to some tools and the skills to use those tools can make another slide rule without knowing a whole lot about it, other than just observing it and duplicating it. Whereas the calculator has got all sorts of hidden functionality. And you can't just look at it and know what it's doing or how it works, and you certainly couldn't reproduce it with a set of hand tools. And the more you talked about the difference between vernacular technologies and the more large-scale industrial technologies, the more I think that the concepts pretty much map one for one. Have you read his book, The Ecotechnic Future, or do you follow his blog at all?
I have not, but I follow his blog fairly frequently, and I've spoken with him a couple of times, and he's, I think, an extremely intelligent commentator on collapse and complexity and the state of our civilization, and certainly would recommend his blog to any of your readers that are listening, but or listeners that are listening. Not sure if this is a transcript or live, I think that it's really a similar concept, and I think that maybe the important thing, maybe even beyond the slide rule concept, is slide rules are pretty much you want the same functionality in almost all of them. And I think that something that's really important, whether it's vernacular architecture, vernacular food production, vernacular clothing or education or healthcare, is that at the vernacular level, if you're at the local level, if you're dealing with vernacular technology, not only can you use locally available knowledge and tools to recreate the tool or the technology, but you can also customize it in a way that's appropriate for your location. You know, and so I think that's maybe why I wouldn't choose the slide rule example, is I think you want your slide rule to always perform the same functions. But you don't want, you know, your garden in Oregon and your garden in Arizona to operate the same way, perform the same functions. You certainly wouldn't want the two to look identical. They'd be dramatically different. They could share information back and forth, but I think that's an example of how being able to customize in a vernacular manner in a locally to improve the local results, I think, is a really important feature of vernacular technology.
Well, then I will agree that they're not one-for-one correspondence between the two concepts, although
very similar in general.
I don't know about a slide rule, but when I was living in Japan in the mid-90s, people, you know, I was surrounded by computers and high technology, but say somebody working the kiosk at the train station would have an abacus in front of him or her and use the abacus to calculate how much change you were going to get. And they did it just automatically. And, you know, and some kids go to abacus specialty school after regular school during the day in Japan. But if you were to get online and do a search, you know, to try to buy an abacus, you're going to find that there are many, many different styles of abacus and that they are, in fact, tailored to individual cultures and individual uses. And I imagine the same could be said for a slide rule.
Yeah, it certainly probably could. I suppose I hadn't thought of ways that you'd want slide rules with different functionality, but they're probably, especially if the more they can perform more advanced functions, I could certainly see certain people in certain professions want this function available, et cetera.
Well, we're just about out of time, but let me throw out one more concept, and you can say why this is important and why it appears in your writing recently. And this is the concept of surge capacity.
This is something it's really been driven home to me lately, but I think that everything from the way I see legal practice management work in my immediate profession to the reason that Chaco Canyon and the Chacoan civilization collapsed, I think can be related back to surge capacity. And that is, if you don't have, and I think I should also back up and say, Kevin Carson has written a fascinating book called The Homebrew Industrial Revolution that focuses on the importance of overhead cost. If you have high overhead costs, then you tend to have to create enough revenue to always be meeting that overhead. And so you maximize, you try and maintain a consistent maximal output from all of your assets. And when you do that, then you don't have the ability to either accept a dramatically lower output for a short while or to really surge when there's some new demand that requires that you rise to the challenge, dramatically increase output for a while. So in law practice, that might be if you expect your attorneys to work 70 hours a week and then a huge new case comes in. Well, you've already been working 70 hours a week. What are you going to do? You can work more and the performance dramatically drops off, or you can squeeze the work into the time available. Either way is not a good option. Same thing with Chaco Canyon. When they had, you know, Chaco was a central site that would redistribute food production from communities to the north and south, which were usually only one at a time, was subject to a drought. So as long as communities in the north produced most years twice as much food as they needed, and the same with communities in the south, then when there was a severe drought on one side, Chaco Canyon could administer the redistribution of food to make sure everyone got fed. But gradually the population in the north and the south, because this redistribution was fairly efficient, and because they had several good years of weather in a row, populations would rise in both the north and the south to where their food production equaled their domestic requirements, their local requirements. And then when there was a drought in the north or a drought in the south, there was no longer enough food to redistribute. And so that led to, increasingly totalitarian government structures, that led to, more extreme farming methods that I think depleted the soils, et cetera, and that also eventually, when there were combined droughts, led to the collapse of the civilization. So I think that's two very different attempts to explain surge capacity. I think in general terms, if you have the ability to get by on a fraction of what you're capable of, you're in a lot better situation, whether that's food production, water, money, you name it, because then when there is a unique demand, you have the ability to rise to meet that challenge.
Well, another long-running theme on the Sea Realm podcast is the my efforts to build awareness of the notion that efficiency is in many respects the opposite of resilience, and that the more you streamline, the more you you put to use excess capacity, the more you eliminate duplication and redundancy, the less surge capacity you're going to have, the less resilient you're going to be when unexpected conditions arise. And I think a really good illustration of this is, the single-income family, say, of the 1950s, where you had the breadwinner and the homemaker. If something should happen to the breadwinner, the homemaker could go to work and bring in some income. And if you don't have much debt, if your house is paid off or whatnot, and something really bad happens and you need money, you can get a mortgage, or you can go into some debt and have some expectation of coming out of it again. But if you've got both husband and wife already working 50 hours a week, and you've already got your credit cards maxed out, and you've already got a second mortgage, and something happens to one of those breadwinners, then you don't really have any surge capacity. You're screwed.
I mean, I think if you were going to try to envision kind of the ideal resilient, high surge capacity domestic economy, you'd have husband and wife, or partner and partner, maybe both working in the, quote, traditional economy, 10 hours a week each, and then working maybe in a much more community-focused organization or production capacity, 10 hours a week each, and then maybe working in domestic production, gardening or other forms of domestic production, 10 hours a week each. And I think that kind of shows a coupling of pushing for localized self-sufficiency. It's not a very efficient system, but I think it's a very resilient system. It has a lot of surge capacity. Probably either one of those people working 10 hours a week maintains enough proficiency or expertise in whatever their traditional state economy area specialty is that they could surge if they had to. I think that's really the direction. Maybe that's just one visualization, but of a direction that we could be pushing, but that's certainly not compatible with the goals of the state economy.
Hard by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shiny black bitch.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruist.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show, or you can leave a comment on the website. We've just set up a Twitter account. You can subscribe at twitter.com/unwelcomeguests. That's all one word. Thanks to Chris from Indie Media for setting that one up. Nice one, mate. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.
Another brave man.